ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for Science Fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
They say that money makes the world go round. Have you ever stopped to consider, though, that money only exists in our minds?
Money is so human. Money doesn't exist in the animal world. Like, your average dog isn't worried about a tenner or a fiver, right? It's, you know, it's a force that we created in our minds, because it doesn't exist. We just make the stuff up. But it's a Promethean force that we created inside our minds. And in order to do that, we had to make so many intellectual and social shortcuts.
Yeah.
And the coin is a great example of that.
Hello, ABC Radio National's Big Ideas is where you've landed. This is your front row seat to the best live events, and my name is Natasha Mitchell. Today, bringing you the rock star Irish economist David McWilliams. He's on a mission to demystify money through his top-rating podcast, his books, his docos, his newspaper columns, and as founder of the world's only economics and stand-up comedy festival, Kilconomics. From clay tablets to coins, credit cards to crypto, this former Irish central banker reckons money is humanity's greatest invention. His latest book is The History of Money, A Story of Humanity, and he joins us on Big Ideas today from the stage of the Wheeler Centre for Books and Ideas in Naarm, Melbourne, with host, ABC broadcaster and author Jacinta Parsons. And a heads up, yeah, a sprinkling of colourful language ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And thank you so much, Jacinta. Thank you very much indeed.
I said you sold your economist colleagues down the river with this, because you say in the book that economists take the fun out of money, a highly emotional substance. Money can be transgressive, sexy, dangerous, mind-altering. Money is power. It's domination. But it can also be liberation. Do you think we'd have less volatility in our world if economists actually went deep into the romance of money?
No, they'd be awful. They'd be awful. Look, I have spent 30 years, Jacinta, as a monetary economist. I've worked in the central bank, I've worked in investment banks, I've worked in universities, I teach the stuff in university, I've done documentaries about it, journalism, all that sort of stuff. But about 10 years ago, I remember thinking to myself, I met some former colleagues of mine who were central bankers, like bigwig central bankers. We were chatting away, and I thought to myself, is this really going to be a bit of a revelation for me? Because economists have, my tribe, and I'm a fully paid up member of the tribe, economists have taken it upon ourselves to explain money to everyone. That's part of the... I describe economists a bit like Catholic priests in the 17th century, right? Okay, so you can imagine, like, so the Catholic priest comes in, they make sure the Mass is in Latin so nobody has a clue what's going on. And then they say, look, don't you be worried now about the God fella, right? I've got a direct line to him. I'll tell you what he's thinking, and then I'll tell you guys. So in a way, economists are a wee bit like that in the real world.
Yeah.
Like, we go on television and we say, oh, well, monetary policy is tight, and consequently, you know, and people are like, yeah, okay, that sounds good. But what really struck me is that economists do not understand money. That is the central motivational force for me writing this book, that this substance that is so crucial to us, it's everywhere, it's, you can't imagine our world without money and without understanding this thing. And what economists can do is, Jacinta, I've said in the book, if you go and you've got a leak in your house, right, and you employ a plumber, and the plumber comes in, and I'm sure plumbers in Melbourne throw the same shapes as plumbers in Dublin, right? Because they realise straight away they're in a monopoly position.
Yeah.
Right? You're an idiot and they know what's going on. So the price goes through the roof, right? There's no bans. And they use that, as they say in Dublin, yeah, get somebody else now if you're so clever, right? So, but a plumber will tell you, here in this building, how the water goes around the building, how if you turn on the tap, a combination of pressure and a little bit of engineering will push the water in a certain way. They'll be able to tell you exactly what happens where the leaks are. So they can tell you how the water goes around the building, okay? But if you took that plumber for a pint afterwards and you asked the plumber about water, but you said, why is water essential for life, to the plumber? Now, you'd be very hard-pressed to get a plumber who'd be able to answer you. And I think the same thing is the same for economists. Economists can tell you how the money goes around. Like, see the big pipe there, right? And if we squeeze interest rates a wee bit, well, less money will go around there. And if we put the pipe over there, it'll land in your pocket, et cetera, et cetera. So economists tell us about the plumbing of the economy and how money goes from A to B. What they can't tell us is what money does to us. And this is what I found interesting. So I'm sitting in the central bank as a young man, as a young economist, thinking, we are talking about the most transgressive, the most exciting, the most dangerous substance that we know. And economists never tell you about that bit. What they tell you about is the plumbing. So this book is all about an economist who, after about 30 years, decided, hold on a second, let's look at this question. What is money? What does it do to us? And how, more importantly, has it been absolutely crucial in human history?
You say in the book, it's sort of behind every evolution in technology. And in fact, you ground us initially in the idea that money is a technology.
Yes.
It's a social technology.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
So one of the fascinating things, again, about technology is when we talk about technology, people think, oh, the wheel or the steam engine or the internet. You know, think about physical technologies, right? Things that make it easier to lift things or to move things or whatever. But there's also these things called social technologies. And social technologies, Jacinta, are things that make humans collaborate better, yeah, that make humans cooperate. A very, very good example is the legal system. And even a biological social technology is this thing in our larynxes here called the voice box. This is an extraordinary thing. No other animal has it, and this is what makes us very special. It's a social technology. It allows us to communicate together in a language that we all understand. Money, if you look at it in this way, is something similar. So I was thinking about money. Why did it kind of emerge when it did, which is about 5,000 years ago? And if you look at the history of humanity, for the first 300,000 or 400,000 years, we're roaming around, doing our thing, hunter-gatherers, evolving slowly. And then we get the end of the Ice Age. And something happens in the end of the Ice Age, which is loads more of the earth becomes available for arable pasture. So what happens is some humans begin the process of saying, that walking around stuff, not into it. I think I'll do some gardening here. You know, I think I'll do a speck of gardening. Because I actually do think domesticity was a bit like gardening. Actually, it was kind of part-time market gardeners, right? Okay. But something very interesting happens to the human population. So let's say the Ice Age happens 10,000 years ago. For the first 5,000 years of the move, the warming of the planet, the human population increased only by 1 million. It went from 4 million to 5 million, according to ancient demographers. And for the second 5,000 years, this is 5,000 years before Christ, the second 5,000 years, the human population went from 5 million to 100 million. So you had this extraordinary expansion of the human population. You think, well, why did that happen? And the most plausible reason is the following, is that when we domesticated animals, they were more dangerous to us than we were to them. So, for example, we started getting things like tuberculosis, like flu, like swine flu. Diseases, pathogens that were in the animals, that jumped to us because for the first time ever we were living in proximity, and it took us a few thousand years to develop immunity. But as we did, and gradually, we developed immunity, so the human population begins. So we had a sort of almost like a pandemic, a constant pandemic for a while. Then the human population expands. And then you think, well, what seemed to have happened then? Well, what happened then was that humans started to live in urban centres for the first time. And then you see the emergence of a couple of things, a couple of social technologies. The first one is money, but we don't know if it's the first. It co-evolves. So money, mathematics,
yeah.
Writing. Then we begin the process of all sorts of other things like legal systems, organized religions, right? And if you think like an organized religion is only a way of setting the rules, like don't do this, do this. Like when Moses comes down, he's got a set of rules, like, as my son said to me once, when he was about 11, most Irish kids don't swear, but unfortunately mine does. And he'd been learning about the Ten Commandments in school, and he came in and he put his thing, he said, Dad, I said, yes, son, what's the story? He says, see them Ten Commandments? I said, yeah. I said, well, he said, what do you think of them? I said, I don't know. That's a very odd thing. I said, it's just a set of rules about how not to be a wanker.
So beautifully.
Beautifully, right. So the point is, what you see organized religions,
yeah.
You see writing, you see mathematics, and you see money all co-evolving at the same time. Why? Because all of these are social technologies, whether it's a legal system, whether it's a religion, whether it's mathematics to count, whether it's the writing to take things down, all of these are functions of complex human relations. And the complexity is a function of the expansion of the population. So for many, many years, humans had to deal with problems of small numbers. But in the last 5,000 years, we've had to deal with problems of large numbers. And I look at money as a human invention to allow us deal with the increasingly complexity of our lives as more and more of us live together. And therefore, we see money emerging in the Sumerian region, which is around southern Iraq, and in ancient China, around the Yangtze River, when urbanization started. So money, cities, urbanization, civilization, they all go together.
And that's what this book is so compelling with. Like the question that keeps coming through it is, why did it happen, where it did, and when it did?
Yeah.
And one of the great, interrogations that you sort of mount is that Christianity, when we're talking about organized religion, emerged almost as a counter-revolution to money, possibly directly. That money was there, and then we see that the beginning of Jesus Christ, etc.
I mean, it's one thing that's always intrigued me about money then and now is the promise of money for all of us is that with this substance, with this magic tool, as I call it in the book, with this force, you and me, we can actually change our social position. Now, this is an incredibly liberating force in all humanity. And I think this is the major reason that people want to acquire money, not because of its end in itself, but because it propels you, it gives you more options. It's a tool for liberation. And what I noticed when I was writing the book is that if you look at the Greek civilization, so the book basically starts at the Stone Age and ends in Bitcoin. So what happens is most civilizations up till the Greeks, well, a crowd called the Lydians before the Greeks, were non-monetary civilizations. They were just beginning the process. The Greeks were the first civilization to absolutely become a monetized civilization. They mined in a place called Larium, and they mined many hundreds of millions of coins. This is phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
And so Greek society and the Greek hinterland was the first civilization to use money. And it's also the reason I believe the Greeks actually smashed through the intellectual ceiling that kept the Egyptians down and previous civilizations down. I've always understood, why was it these Greek fellas who came up with philosophy, with rationality, ultimately with republicanism, democracy. Why did that crowd come up with it? And I believe it's related to the fact that they were the first monetary society, and money, because it allowed an element of social uplift, liberated not just people's pockets, people's minds to think about a different thing. Because if you have a monetized society, you have a numerically astute society. You can count. And it's a very simple jump between numericals, mathematics and rationality and logic.
And later on you describe that that becomes also a capacity for society to accept science.
Because absolutely.
Suddenly numeracy means that they understand rationality, means that they will accept things based on numbers.
Exactly. So all that stuff that's going on in the Greek mind, that shift from mythos, which they called the way they believed in stuff before money, to logos, to logic, I don't think can be told without the influence of this substance. Right, that's the first thing. Second thing, though, the problem is that if you're moving from a society, Jacinta, where you believe in gods, you say, well, I'm poor because Zeus said I was poor, or Prometheus said I was poor. Well, that's cool. That's kosher. That's all right. I'm poor. It's all good. And then so you've got a very strict hierarchy in pre-monetary societies. In monetary societies, very gradually, you begin to see the emergence of the merchant class, the dexterous class with money. And they start doing something very strange to society. They start making the point that you can change your position. So that's very, very liberating for those who are good with money. But for those who are not, for those who lose out in this new monetary world, somebody needs to give them a countervailing narrative to hold on to. And that is why it's always intrigued me, is why Jesus came where he did and when he did. He comes where he did because he's a product of an urban proto-Roman Greek society who were using money. We know that because he was chasing fellas out of moneylenders out of the temple, right?
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is his message is extraordinarily radical. So Jesus' message is, in a world where people up to now were believing in Zeus and massive kind of macho gods, right? You know, think kind of like Zeus. Think like, imagine like if Elon Musk had wings, right? That type of creature, okay?
He'll make them soon enough.
Yeah. So people believed in that. And then you say, well, and therefore the strong man, the macho guy, the tough guy, he was the guy who owned everything. And along comes this shepherd dude, our son of a shepherd, and he says, look, no, the meek will inherit the earth. The poor are stronger than the rich. It will be more difficult for a rich man to get to heaven than it is for the camel to go through the eye of the needle. Like, these are very radical ideas. And I think the reason that Christianity was so unbelievably potent and the soil, the social soil was so fertile, was because it had been disrupted by money. And as a result of that, the losers in the money economy needed a story to hold on to, and that story was the next world. And that's why I think it happened when it did.
Tracing the ancient connections between religion and money, the popular Irish economist and podcaster David McWilliams. He's our big thinker today on Big Ideas, right here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app with me, Natasha Mitchell. He's talking about his latest book. It's called The History of Money, A Story of Humanity, with an audience at the Willa Centre and host, author and ABC local radio presenter, Jacinta Parsons.
Thinking about it as well, at that introduction of coins, we look at that, and I love this thing that you wrote. Accepting coinage requires humans to accept a new faith where tokens represent value. In the tabernacle of human mind, the coin works as a shortcut, denoting the value of an immense array of real commodities and experiences. That's, I mean, the idea that we had to kind of transport ourselves into a faith almost around these things, and then later on paper money was even the same experience that we had.
Yeah, it's a mad idea. So again, what I'm trying to do is, if you can, when you're writing books like this, and again, you're sitting during COVID and you're thinking, what am I going to do? I'm in the basement for months on end. And you begin to explore things that you'd been slightly interested in, but then you become obsessed about. And one of those was the notion of coins. And what a leap of human imagination it must have taken for somebody to rock up and say, you see that little bit of copper there? And you don't even know if it's copper or not. That's worth 2 cows, 6 pints, and let's say a pair of shoes. And you're like, have you been smoking crack? Okay. Or collectively, do we all have to smoke crack?
Yes, we do.
And so that idea that coins are, it's such an extraordinary leap of human imagination. One of the reasons I also love writing this book about money was money is so human. Money doesn't exist in the animal world. Like, your average dog isn't worried about a tenner or a fiver, right? It's, you know, it's a force that we created in our minds, because it doesn't exist. We just make the stuff up. But it's a Promethean force that we created inside our minds. And in order to do that, we had to make so many intellectual and social shortcuts.
Yeah.
And the coin is a great example of that. The other factor is that once you start putting coins in people's pockets, when you move money from your brain to your pocket in transactions, you begin the process of spreading what we would now know as commerce. And commerce demands your brain to make extraordinary gymnastic leaps about value. And yet we do it all the time.
Yeah.
And like, our kids do it. I mean, I've always been intrigued by this. It's almost as if, I mean, what I say in the book is that for the first about 300,000 years of our existence, fire was the technology that dominated human relationships. Once we mastered fire, we began to master the world. I think now, if you look back at those 5,000 years from 3,000 BC, the Sumerians, to now, we have moved from being what anthropologists called a pyrophyte species, which is a species that has adapted to a technology called fire, to a plutophyte species, which is a species adapted to money. And also part of that is there's something intrinsic in our understanding, like language, of things like value. Like, you don't pass on to your son. I never said to my son and daughter, okay, well, you know, this thing in dad's back pocket, which is called a tenner, is worth it. For some reason, like a process of osmosis, they absorbed it. So money's so central to us.
And you make a really interesting point, which I didn't think you were going to make in this book, but you say, we often say money is the root of all evil. But if we really interrogate, money is the root of relationships.
Exactly.
It is the root of the way that we must find a way to collaborate with each other.
It's the root to strangers. That's the key.
Yeah.
So if you think about the amount of people, even today, Jacinta, that you have exchanged with something over money, complete strangers, a cup of coffee, a Sambo, or, you know, a pint, you know, going out, you buy something. Money allows us to make a deal with people we don't know and will never see again. Now, this is a phenomenally interesting thing, because what it does is it creates these massive networks. Now, when I was, of course, in school, in a good Catholic school, I was told money is the source of all evil. And
yes.
I thought, oh, Jesus, that sounds right. Absolutely, Father, whatever you say. It was great. Anyway, in Ireland in the 80s, we had no money, so it didn't matter. You know, because money was somebody else's problem. We'd have to deal with it, right? Aussies had to deal with it. People were wealthy, you know. But and I kind of believed it. I thought, that sounds logical. And then I started to think about it. And you think, no, because societies willingly adopted money for a reason. Nobody forced them to. It's a bottom-up technology. And the reason they did is because, rather than me say, I'd quite like that, but to get that thing there, that camel or a donkey, I'm going to have to kill the fellow who owns the donkey, right? Old school. I know, technically, old school way of getting things, right?
And then in the back alleys of Dublin.
In the back alleys of Dublin, where there are many donkeys. And then you say, no, I'll give this fellow a token of value called money, and he will willingly give me the donkey. So suddenly what you see is societies that heretofore would have conflicted over assets, resources, etc., begin to trade. Mm. And trade is an alternative to fighting. And as that alternative spreads, more and more societies... One of the interesting things about money is as societies began to adopt money in the Mediterranean, for example, which is the area I've studied most in this particular book, money conferred a competitive advantage on those societies that took it. And I think the competitive advantage was they didn't have to fight so much. So it's just another way of looking at it.
It's so interesting. And there's thrilling parts for a non-economic brain.
This is great.
By the way, I should say, a glass of wine, you can see it out the corner of your eye, can't you, David? Is sitting over there. It's about to make its
Where
way to the...
Where is it? Oh.
Everyone, give the glass of wine a round of applause as it makes its way stage.
As we were being... Thank you so much. We were becoming so ecclesiastical, I thought we'd have our own wedding of Cana. Here. So the water has now turned into wine.
What I was thrilled reading is, while this is an incredible book to track humanity and her innovations through a study into money, humanity is also revealed, who we are, how we believe. One of the most fascinating moments for me in this book is your discussion on zero.
Oh,
and
yes.
How European thinking and Christian philosophies could, and philosophers, Greek philosophers, could not account for that being nothing. That there couldn't be a nothing.
Yeah, no, it's very important. By the way, there's very little religion, believe it or not, in this book, right? We just have just gone that road. But it's just a fascinating leap. So what you see when you start studying the history of money is there are moments when there are almost technological leaps made in the use of money and in the use of trade and commerce and whatever. And one of those technological leaps appears to have happened, did happen in Sicily in the 12th century. So Sicily in the 12th century, so Sicily now has got a terrible connotations of Goodfellas and the Godfather and all that sort of stuff. But Sicily, and we tend to dismiss, even Italians tend to dismiss, there's a lot of looking down their nose at Sicily. But that actually obscures the fact that Sicily was a shining light of the Enlightenment in the 12th and 11th century in Europe.
Enormous diversity.
Enormous, and that's the extraordinary thing. So if you think of the Crusades, Crusades was a Christian jihad against non-Christians, right? An appalling thing, right? So Arabs, Jews, Byzantine Christians, when I say Christian, I mean a Roman Christian jihad, okay, Catholic jihad, if you will, right, against non-Roman Catholics, right? In the 11th century and 12th century in Sicily, you have an extraordinary example of cosmopolitan life. So the Normans took the island over. They actually went to Sicily 10 years after they went to Ireland. They should have stayed in Sicily, I suspect, because they stuck around Ireland. Actually, there's loads of words in the Irish language are French because of the Normans. But for some reason, I don't know why, and people have... The Normans decided that they would keep the Muslim farmers and merchants. They would keep the Jewish farmers and merchants. They would allow the Byzantine Christians, i.e. the people who believed in Greek Orthodox Christianity, who'd been there for years, hang out. And they themselves would be Roman Catholic. But they'd leave everyone trade, speak, integrate, assimilate, live with each other. It's an extraordinary example of multiculturalism. Now, why was this? This is the question. Because there has to be a reason for this. If you're doing something that the rest of the world is not doing at the time. And the reason was commerce, right? That the Arabs had acquired this thing that Western theologists called Saracen magic. So Saracen was a slang word for Arabs, or not so much Arabs, but people of the Muslim faith from North Africa. And what was the magic? The magic was zero. So what happened was the Arabs conquered Persia and they took back everything from Persia that they thought was valuable. And one of the things they took back was this idea of zero. And the Persians had robbed zero from the Indians.
That's right.
Right? And I suspect the Indians robbed it from the Chinese, because when you write a book like this, you realise everything was made in China first.
That's right.
Everything. No, seriously, everything. You're just like, oh my God, not again, for fuck's sake. China again.
Paper money as well.
Everything. Basically, everything was made in China, and now still is. So it's all grand. It's come the full circle, right? But the reason this is important is that zero allows us to think in very big numbers, number one. It allows us to do fractions and ratios and algebra, number two. And what happened was, because Christian philosophy is based on Greek thought, and Greek thought is founded on the notion of proof, having something like zero, which in effect means the void, the nothing, freaked out Christian thinkers. So we ignored it, but the Indians were very happy with the void. They were very happy with zero, and they were very happy with exploring ideas of eternity and the void and this number. And they passed this on to the Arabs, and the Arabs realized that not only was this an intellectually fascinating thing, because you can go from positive to negative numbers, which is very, very difficult still for lots of children to understand. I have two cows. How can I have negative two cows, right? It's very hard for a lot of people to understand. But once you start using zero, you can start using basic mathematics and counting and dividing and multiplying in your head. And this was a tool that Arab merchants had, and they gave it to the Christians in Sicily. And the Christians in Sicily used it so much so that the other traders thought that they were possessed by the devil when they could come up with these figures so quickly in their head, and they were just using algebra.
And it was banned for some time.
It was banned in Florence until the end of the 13th century, because the Vatican was freaked out by it. But the point was...
Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible. The point was, once we got zero, we got things like double entry back bookkeeping, we got things like basic mathematics, basic algebra. That meant that you could have all sorts of computations going in your head. You could express things as ratios and percentages of other things. All of that comes from a small technology, which is an enormous technology, which is the idea of zero. And it took hundreds of years for it to get to Europe. But when it did, this is the fascinating thing, when the Florentines accepted zero and began to teach mathematics in things they called reckoning schools, we also see an extraordinary flamboyant expansion of European commerce out of Florence, out of Genoa, out of northern Italy. And that is the basis of the Renaissance. Without zero, you have no Renaissance. And the guy who brought it was a guy called Fibonacci.
We love Fibonacci.
And Fibonacci was the little boy who went to... His dad is a tax collector in Algeria, and he deposited the family in Sicily, and it was the little boy, Fibonacci, who learned from Arab instructors, and he brought it to Florence.
And was that one of the fundamental first books really on economics?
Yes.
And was that the influence throughout Europe then?
Yeah, it was called Liber Abaci, which is the book of numbers. And what Fibonacci did, which is what I think all great teachers do, is they took examples from everything. So rather than say, look, this is very interesting, it's algebra and it's very hard, and all, you know, remember, like, you know, I know most of my mates in school were freaked out by carry the one in the long division. They was like, what the hell does that mean? You know, they were Jesus, man, right? Okay.
But it is a leap of faith.
It is a leap of faith.
Isn't it?
It's all a leap of faith.
And
this is the whole history of money is the history of the human mind accepting the unacceptable and moving forward. And as a result of that, the development of us humans as a species and our relationship with this bizarre thing called money are profoundly inextricable. It's impossible to conceive of us without money. And the amazing thing is we don't ask these questions, ever.
That's what really struck me in this book, as I said. I started reading it thinking, I know what this will be about, the fiction of money, or there'll be some...
some economist bloke.
Some guy, you know, from Ireland. But what it does is And again, there's something really beautiful about how it exposes and reveals the human and their capacities, not only the evolution of technology, yeah, but of spirit and collaboration.
Well, I think if you love humanity and you love people and you have good friends and you see the silliness in us, right? And I always do that. I think that economics amazingly takes the humanity out of humans.
Yeah.
It turns us into robots.
That's right.
And creatures that we aren't.
It's funny because
I teach it in Trinity, and the kids come in, and you know, I say to the kids, "Who's done economics in school before?" And so, you know, it's always the boys put up their hands, right? It's just a jock thing. "Oh, of course, I've done that, professor, blah, blah, blah." And I say, "Oh, yeah, great, good for you, young fella. And what did you learn in economics?" And they say things like, "Well, we learned that the first rule of economics when we were in school is man is rational." And I say, "Have you... what does that mean?" They say, "We're cold and we're scientific and we're numerical and we're not encumbered by biases and emotions." And I'm saying, "Have you ever met a human like that? Would you go for a drink with someone like that?" No, you wouldn't. So my point is, the book, but once you start thinking about it, it's just the story of humanity.
Money hasn't always had a great rap, has it? But Irish economist and author David McWilliams wants us to see its human side. He's talking about his new book, The History of Money, A Story of Humanity, here on Big Ideas, which is your home for big thinkers at the best live events on ABC Radio National, with me, Natasha Mitchell. And today he's speaking with host, my ABC colleague, the wonderful Jacinta Parsons, who's now considering a little-known interpretation of The Wizard of Oz.
You posit The Wizard of Oz...
Oh, yes.
..as the metaphor for the US connection with the gold standard. And, like, what an incredible leap. And, and that the characters of The Wizard of Oz, you take this away, represent...
This is all true. So there was an election in 1896, and the election was between a fellow called McKinley, who Donald Trump fancies himself to be the modern-day version of, okay, another fellow called Brian Jennings. So these are the two fellows involved. But the underlying issue was that McKinley was on the side of very rich people, and very rich people wanted to maintain the gold standard. And Brian Jennings was on the side of a party called the Populist Party, and they wanted the Americans to adopt the silver standard. And the reason they wanted is there's more silver around than there is gold. So if the dollar is related to silver and not gold, there'll be more dollars around. So why do they want more dollars around? They want more dollars around because huge swathes of the United States, particularly the farmers... One of the interesting things is about farming is farmers are always in debt because they reap... and then they sow. And the period between reaping and sowing, you've no money. So one of the histories of banking starts at farming. So farmers needed money to tide them over. So what was happening in the United States was the farmers in the West, so the Midwest, so around the time that Melbourne was beginning to boom after the gold rush, so the Midwest in America, these farmers were constantly in debt. But what they had to pay their debt was corn and wheat. But they had to pay their debt back in gold because the dollar was linked to gold. So every year they were forced to pay back more of their product for the same amount of debt. So they wanted a change. The people in the south of the states, the whites in the south of the states, after them losing in the war of the Civil War, meant that the white farmers in the United States lost almost everything. And they too wanted an easier standard. So that's, you know, so far so normal. And then you think, well, what's the Wizard of Oz about? So the Wizard of Oz is an allegory written about the election of 1896, where Dorothy represents, she's from Kansas. Kansas is the dead center of America, and she's a farmer's daughter. So Dorothy is the average, innocent farmer's daughter, little Miss Average American. The yellow brick road are the yellow bricks of gold. The Wizard of Oz himself, if you look behind Oz, is the symbol for gold. What you also find is that the Tin Man represents the industrial worker who's been shafted because he's got no gold, he's been paid. The straw man represents the farmer. And, of course, the Emerald City represents the city, which is emerald. Emerald's the colour of the dollar, which is backed by gold. And the entire allegory is one where eventually, when Dorothy faces down the Wizard of Oz, who is McKinley, the president, they realise he has no power. And the extraordinary thing about it is that most Americans, around Christmas time or Thanksgiving, watch that. It's the most watched movie in the United States. They sing together over the rainbow, and they have no idea that they're singing about the gold standard. And that's the story. And it's an extraordinary
it's
story.
It's extraordinary.
Isn't it? Yeah. So the whole thing is about the Wizard of Oz.
I wish I had more time to dig into so many of those stories throughout our history that money illuminates in a completely different way than when we first perhaps understood it. But I cannot let you leave this stage without asking you about crypto. And of course, as we come this direction, we cannot have this man on stage without that. We could almost fast forward this and say, you know, your position here is that crypto is not money. It doesn't sort of reach the three standards or thresholds that money does. But there is a really interesting monetary innovation that's happened in Africa.
Yes. So, I mean, just on the crypto thing.
Yeah, let's go there.
Like, crypto is something, but it's not money. Mm. Bitcoin is something, but it's not money. And by that I mean money is one of these incredibly ephemeral concepts, but what actually gives money its real value, so what gives the Aussie dollar its real value, is that everybody on this continent, or this country, uses it. Everybody recognises it. They know what it is. So if you're up in the Pilbara or you're down here, you use the dollar. So it's the usability that gives the Aussie dollar its value. And I don't mean value in terms of its actual, the amount of dollars vis-a-vis the amount of US dollars. I mean its intrinsic worth, what makes it worthwhile. And that's why I've always thought that, in a way, money is like language. So we're here speaking the English language. The English language is incredibly valuable, not because of its intrinsic value, but because all of us speak it. Mm. And that allows us to communicate. Is the English language the easiest language in the world? No way. Ask somebody who's had to learn it as a foreigner. It's really hard. It's really irregular. The grammar doesn't make sense. I remember trying to explain this to a friend of mine, and she's a foreigner. She's from Serbia. And then I was going out on stage, and somebody said, break a leg. And she's like, what the fuck? She'd been trying to learn English for 10 years, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have all these things that we know them, right?
Yeah.
So money and our currencies are a bit like the English language, like the dollar, American dollar would be like the English language. Is it perfect? No. Would we, if we were recreating money from the start, would we create something different? Yeah. Is the banking system perfect? No. Is the way in which mortgages are made and the rate of it, is all perfect? No. But it is what it is. It's like the English language. Yeah. The problem with crypto is that if the dollar and our currencies are like English, crypto is like Esperanto. It's the Esperanto of money. Have you ever met anybody who speaks Esperanto? Right? They will bore the arse off you, right? And crypto's the same.
Crypto's the same.
Yeah, exactly. You're at a dinner party, someone goes, crypto. I was like, oh man, let me go. It's incredibly important for people who own it, and the rest of us couldn't give a sugar, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's the deal, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think now, I've said in the book, that crypto is like the most terrifying thing in democracy isn't a countervailing narrative or communism. It is a residence committee, right? A very well-organized middle-class residence committee can destroy almost everything in society, okay? Right? And I think crypto is a bit like, so a residence committee is like a lobby group. We don't want that train. We don't want that new block of apartments, blah, blah, blah. And the idea of the lobby group is you lobby the people in power to change the status quo. Crypto is just a lobby group for rich people. right? So they're trying to, you know, inveigle themselves into the United States, into Donald Trump. Donald Trump is very happy because he is at the top of a heist. His sons are printing money that they are creating monumental returns out of. The other thing is that money is social. And money is as much part of a democracy as the army is. So the Aussie dollar is as essential to Australia as the Australian police force, right? Because the state needs to own money, because otherwise private people will own money, and the very people who print money, the private people, will get all the readies. So my view of crypto is that it is something, but it's not what we understand as money. And the reason I feel this is that I always get the impression crypto is a solution looking for a problem, right?
Yeah.
As a general rule,
yeah,
we have problems and then we say, how do we solve that, right? Okay, hammer, nail, all that good stuff, right? Whereas crypto, somebody announced about 10 years ago, oh, there's a problem. I said, really, where is it now? Jesus, I haven't seen that before. Oh, there's a problem in the international global financial system. It's awful. That was it. That was the problem. It was announced. And then some fellow says, and there's a Japanese lad who's come up with this thing. And this is the solution, right? In general, because money is a technology, it works the other way around. You have a problem, you get a solution. And I noticed this. I was in Kenya about 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And I was doing some work for a charity. And I'd never been in Nairobi before. Mad city, great, great place. And so I'm looking at, there's all these people in Nairobi. It's a big, big African city, sophisticated place, etc. But again, lots and lots of little small lanes and alleyways and whatever. And there's loads and loads of people outside some, it looked like a little, like a pop-up shop. So I say to the African lad beside me, I say, what's the story there? What are they doing? And he's selling mobile phone credit. And I said, what? He's selling mobile phone credit. And I thought, well, why are there so many people around? He said, well, he's a bank. I said, he's what? He said, he's a bank. And I said, what's going on? There's a thing in Kenya, actually in most of sub-Saharan Africa, called M-Pesa. And M-Pesa was a way of turning mobile phone credit into money. So what happened in the case in rural Africa, if you went into the city and you were working and you were sending money back to, let's say, the family, or it could be lots of cousins or brothers, like a lot of people. In the old days, the only way you could do it, you gave it to a bus driver, a bag of money called shillings, Kenyan shillings. And the bus driver said, well, you can bring that down to me, granny. He said, yeah, no problem, I will do, but it'll cost you 30% interest rate. And the chances of her getting it are predicated on the honesty of the bus driver. And the reason they couldn't do what we do is because they had no banking system, because the place was too poor. So somebody came up with a great idea, bottom-up idea as well. So, well, we all know what mobile phone credit is worth when they first started getting mobile phones. So why don't we create a parallel currency called M-Pesa, which is based on mobile phone credit? So what would happen is, let's say Jacinta's living out in the middle of nowhere, and your mum is there. And what happens is you send your mum credit on her phone. And she goes to the shop. And the shop accepts the credit on their phone and sells it back to somebody else. So what you find is that, and this is the joy of money, is that money evolves in ways you'd never imagined. So now in Kenya, which is not a small country, it's a very, very large country, 70% of all transactions are done with M-Pesa, not with the shilling. And so technology has done a bizarre thing. It has turned mobile phone credit into money and the mobile phone itself into a bank. And that's the way money evolves. And that's the way I think it will continue to evolve.
It's a lovely comparison to crypto. And when we look at actually
yes,
that bottom up and how that works.
Yeah.
It's time for questions from our audience, but I need to say one of my favourite sentences in the book happens on your last page. You need to answer this for me. Advanced civilizations have electric cars, smartphones, vaccines, coffee machines, and then you say dance clubs. What the hell? That's moment in the book I went, what is he talking about?
I think dance clubs are a form of very highly evolved civilization.
Wow.
I really do. Because when you're sitting there as an economist, you're thinking, okay, well, what do we talk about civilizations, you know, electric toothbrushes? These things are very important, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, where do people go? You know, where they hang out at raves. Yeah. And that's an interesting advanced civilization idea.
You know, I love it.
I'm not the typical economist.
But what a beautiful opportunity it has been to hear you speak to us about, I'm going to say the word beautiful, the book Money. It surprised the hell out of me that it moved me in the way it did.
That's so lovely to hear.
And that it challenged conceptually things that I had taken for granted. And I think whether you're an economist, whether you love a bit of nerdery around money or you don't, this is the story of our humanity. And you will buy it. And you will get it signed perhaps tonight, and maybe you'll buy a Guinness and throw it at his face. Please, again, make him blush with Irish pride. David McWilliams.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. What a journey, and I wonder what money will look like in another 100 years' time. Well, on Big Ideas, that was the very entertaining David McWilliams, Irishman, economist, popular podcaster, and author of the book The History of Money, A Story of Humanity. He was speaking with the also very entertaining Jacinta Parsons, ABC local radio presenter. Her latest book is called Wisdom of Age, Lessons on Living from Our Wise Elder Women. Yes, yes, yes to that. Special thanks to the hosts, the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for books and ideas. Now, I want to tell you about a special series we're running all next week on Big Ideas, the prestigious BBC Reith Lectures with the Dutch historian and best-selling author Rutger Bregman. He reckons the world is in a rotten way. It's governed by so-called unserious elites. And he's mining examples from history to inspire a moral revolution in each and every one of us.
I know I've made a name for myself writing hopeful books about the goodness in humanity and the utopias we can build together. But today, it would feel dishonest to begin on an optimistic note. As the Italian philosopher Antonio Gramsci wrote in 1926, scribbling in a notebook from a fascist prison, "The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." To grasp the depths of our current misery, it helps to start with a classic story of collapse. When the great historian Edward Gibbon described the decline of Rome, he didn't speak in vague abstractions. He gave us names, dates, and details, page after page of cowardice and corruption. Reading the decline and fall of the Roman Empire is like watching a civilization rot in slow motion. Sadistic emperors on gilded thrones, generals who sold out their own armies, and senators who cared more for spectacle than statecraft. And yet, what shocks you most when you read Gibbon today isn't the depravity, it's the familiarity. Gibbon wrote about politicians who lacked seriousness, elites who lacked virtue, and societies that mistook decadence for progress. Now, 2,000 years later, we live in an age where billionaires dodge their taxes, politicians perform instead of govern, and media barons profit from lies and hatred. The Roman elite fiddled while Rome burned. Our elites livestreamed the fire and monetized the smoke. Immorality and unseriousness, those are the two defining traits of our leaders today. And they're not accidental flaws, but the logical outcome of what I call the survival of the shameless. Today, it's not the most capable who rise, but the least scrupulous. Not the most virtuous, but the most brazen.
Yeah, it's a compelling listen. You will not want to miss it. I can't wait to bring you the BBC Reith series. And this has been ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. If you're planning an event, we love hearing from you because it might sound great on the national airwaves right here on Big Ideas. Get in touch. bigideas@abc.net.au is our email address. Thanks for your company today. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.